This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In 1940, American Varian Fry went on a secret mission to Marseille. He carried a list of names of people who found themselves trapped in occupied France. Fry launched a rescue operation, saving more than 1,000 people from the Nazis, including Hannah Arendt, Marc Chagall, André Breton, and Jacques Lipchitz. Without Fry, what great works of thought, art, and literature might not exist? Until now, though, had you ever heard the name or heard anything about him? He's unknown to most, but that may change. A book chronicling his life is now available. Sheila Eisenberg has written a biography titled A Hero of Our Own, The Story of Varian Fry. It's published by Random House. Fry biographer Sheila Eisenberg is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join the discussion. I invite your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to A Hero of Our Own, Sheila Eisenberg is the author of Women Who Love, Men Who Kill, and co-author with William Kunstler of his autobiography, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. She's a former journalist. She teaches English at Marist College. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Sheila Eisenberg, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
How is it that most of us have never heard of Varian Fry?
Well, he died 30 years ago, first of all, and when he came home from Marseille in 1941, not much was written about him, and he certainly didn't tout his own escapades and heroism. And I think also it's a factor of the sort of reticence we all had after World War II. People did not choose to speak or write much about the war immediately after it, or even in the decades, the 50s and 60s following. It's only recently that we've been sort of plied with The Greatest Generation and lots of World War II stories. So I think somehow he slipped between the cracks, and we just somehow didn't hear about him. It was a sad misfortune.
Yeah. When did you learn about him, and what led you to say, boy, I got to write a book about this
right
man?
Well, it was about, I think it was December 97, actually. I remember exactly when it was. I was having a discussion with my daughter, Sunshine Flint, who is also a writer. I was looking for a subject for a book to write about, and she said, you know, Mom, I've read about this man, Varian Fry. She saw his name in a footnote in a history book she was reading. And she said it mentions that he saved 1,500 people from the Nazis, and including, as you said in the introduction, Marc Chagall, Jacques Lipchitz, Hannah Arendt. And she said, it sounds like a really fascinating subject. So I said, yes, it does. I did a little research and discovered then that other than Fry's own memoir, which was written in 1945 and reissued, I think, in 1997, no one had written anything about him, and he was totally unknown. If you mentioned his name to people, they said, who's that? And so I said, this sounds like a great subject, and I began my research, and I began writing the book.
Yeah. Was the research difficult?
It was extremely difficult. As someone told me initially, she said, you know, I always wanted to write a book about Fry, someone who was in the field and knew about him, she said, but I was somewhat put off by the fact that so many documents were in French and German, and I don't speak French and German, she said, so that's why she didn't write about him. So I, of course, didn't have any idea what I was getting into, did not know that so many of the documents would be written in French and German, because he corresponded with all the refugees, and he wrote to them. If they wrote to him in French, he wrote back to them in French, because he was a scholar and spoke many languages. So I ended up, you know, having to hire translators and do that. So that was really the most difficult part, I would say.
Yeah.
Plus, the other thing that really makes it almost, you know, thinking, going into it, if I knew this again, I would have been put off by the impossibility of it. Because his rescue mission was a secret mission, all of the papers were burned or destroyed in some other way, so that there were really no records kept of any of this. So whatever information there was meager and had to be either smuggled out or was remembered by people who lived through the experience. As a matter of fact, kind of an interesting thing happened. Someone, a professor at State University of New York in Albany, found 200 folders with the records of 200 refugees in them, you know, of this large group that Fry dealt with, and he found it in the basement of the International Rescue Committee in New York City. And he somehow, these 200 records survived. So out of the approximately 15,000 refugees that passed through Fry's offices, 200 people's records survived, and that's it. So that was really the other major difficulty in the research, was that the papers had to be destroyed, most of them.
Now, those folks that were rescued or that went through Fry's office, their offspring, were you able to track any of them down?
Yeah, that was really one of the most exciting parts of my research. I had an author's query in the New York Times Book Review, plus I used some of the skills I had learned as a reporter to find people. For example, I found, sort of accidentally, because someone I knew her, I found Lola Lipschitz, Jacques Lipschitz's daughter, and I tracked down quite a number, I'd say several dozen, of either the survivors themselves or their children. And corresponded with them or called them or emailed them or actually in some cases got to meet with them. Yeah. And that was very exciting.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Lola Lipschitz, because here at the University of Illinois at the Krannert Art Museum, an exhibition of Lipschitz's work continues through January 6th.
Mm-hmm.
And in the exhibition is a photograph taken in New York City in 1942 of Lipschitz surrounded by several of this generation of artists who were refugees and saved by Fry.
Really?
Yeah, and it's to see such a large group of artists all sitting together in one spot in New York City in 1942. I believe it was 42. It's been a while since I've been there at the exhibition, but I believe it was 42. And it just says so much about...
Is this the photograph where they're all sort of sitting in a living room on chairs, lined up almost?
Yeah, they're lined up. There's like three rows of them.
Right, yes, I've seen that. That is such an amazing picture.
Yeah.
Because it represents almost, you know, some of the best, the great artists of that whole generation, and they were indeed saved by Fry.
Yeah.
It's truly amazing.
Yeah. Also, while we're on the subject of Lipschitz, thanks to your book, A Hero of Our Own, I know that he was really reluctant to leave Europe.
Yeah, the story that he told, there's a man in New York who videotaped him for something like 300 hours talking about his experiences.
That's here at the university.
Oh, you've got those tapes there.
Yes.
That's wonderful. Well, I interviewed him, and I also got copies, audio tapes of some of the videotapes. And he was reluctant. He was afraid, and he was alternately, I guess, he was afraid and also complacent at the same time. And he, to the end of his life, credited Fry with sort of, you know, getting him up and out and forcing him to take it seriously and forcing him to escape, in a sense.
Yeah. The gentleman who did those tapes, his name is Bruce Bassett.
Yes.
And he did those interviews with Lipschitz in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
It's a wonderful record of a great artist.
Yeah. What put Fry on course for this mission?
Well, it's many, many factors, but it was sort of a convergence of things. Initially, I guess the thing that really got him there in the first place was that after France fell in June 1940. A group of young people in New York City who are somewhat intellectual, educators, journalists, writers, artists, theologians, people who are politically concerned, of course, and politically active, got together and said, you know, we've got to do something to save or help the people who are now stuck in France. Because before the fall of France, all during the late 30s, refugees were going there to find safety from Germany and Eastern European countries. And then after France fell, you know, they had to find safety in the south of France. So people were running to the south of France, and I think Jacques Lipschitz describes that in his tale of how he escaped. So the group got together in New York City. They had a fundraiser to raise money to send over there to help the refugees. And they were very active and intelligent and dynamic young people, and they sat around and said, you know, we really should send someone over there. We can't really do this long distance. And somehow, as Fry wrote in his own memoirs, he volunteered himself. There was no one jumping up and saying, I want to go, so he volunteered. At the time, he was a 32-year-old journalist. He had absolutely no experience in political work or underground work or anything like that. His experience was solely in writing and editing articles, and he, which he was quite good at. And he, after he volunteered himself, they all said, well, great, you know, okay, you can go. You'll be our international, our overseas representative. And he prepared to go by getting, he got a list of names of the most endangered refugees from such people as Eleanor Roosevelt, Alfred Barr, the head of the Museum of Modern Art, Alvin Johnson, the head of the New School, Dorothy Thompson, the renowned journalist. They all sort of got together and they compiled a list of 200 names of the people they considered most in danger. And the criteria they used for this list was who had opposed Hitler the most, who had spoken out against him, who had angered him, and who did they think would be most wanted by him. And they also, of course, included the artists that Hitler had categorized as, quote, degenerate artists. So they gave Fry this list of 200 names and some money, $3,000, and sent him on his way. And that's actually how he got to go there. I mean, his motivation, of course, was much more complex than that.
Yeah, well, tell us about his motivation. What were his politics?
Well, he was a liberal and very much a caring person. He cared about other people, and that was his background in compassion, as I call it, because he his father was a very caring man, and his grandfather, this was so fascinating when I found out, his grandfather was named Charles Reuben Fry, and he was a lifetime social worker, and he worked for the Children's Aid Society. And he was one of those people who led the orphan trains. I don't know if you've ever heard of them,
yes.
But they were trains that took sort of what they deemed to be neglected or abused children from the teeming streets of New York City, put them on trains to the Midwest and West, where they would live with, you know, a sort of more wholesome life. Now, there was some criticism of these orphan trains because some people said, well, it was giving the farmer, you know, unpaid labor. But, you know, I think the overall judgment is that the children who were helped, you know, had a more wholesome life and had more to eat. And so Varian Fry's grandfather did this, and he also ran a summer home for children in Brooklyn, in Bath Beach, Brooklyn, for the Children's Aid Society. So he had a lifetime of, you know, social work and humanitarianism behind him. And Varian Fry basically worshipped and adored both his father and his grandfather, and he wrote extensively about both of them, unpublished sort of remembrances of his father and grandfather that I have copies of, in which he, you know, extols their virtues, and he describes his grandfather as walking through the streets of Manhattan's slums with children running up to him and, you know, loving him and putting their arms out to him, almost like he was a, you know, a godlike or a Santa Claus kind of figure.
Mm.
So that was Fry's background in compassion, and he had a very strong feeling all of his life that people should help one another and that nobody should turn his back or her back on anyone else. His second, you know, strong motivation was his, you know, very, very strong anti-fascism, because he, you know, he was a liberal and he was against fascism, but what sort of solidified his belief system was in 1935, he was hired as editor-in-chief of a magazine that published translated and published articles from the foreign press, Common Sense magazine. And as part of his job, he felt that he should go to Europe and see firsthand what was going on. So in the spring of 1935, he traveled to Germany, and he went to Berlin. And while he was there, he had the unfortunate experience of watching an anti-Jewish sort of raid in the streets, done by Nazis. And he was totally horrified, totally shocked, and he wrote about it in an article that was published in the New York Times. And he was just, he was like 27 years old. He had heard, but he could not believe what he saw. You know, the violence, the blood, the beating up of Jews and all of that. The other thing was, in the same trip to Berlin, he interviewed a man named Ernst Putzi Hansnagel, which is very difficult to say. Now, I'm going to call him Putzi because that's easier for me to say. Putzi was a fascinating man himself. He was half German, half American. He had attended Harvard and graduated 10 years before Fry did. Fry graduated in 32. Putzi graduated in 22. Putzi, after he graduated from Harvard, somehow found his way over to Germany, I guess to check out the German side of his family background, and became very close to Hitler and ended up working for Hitler. He was part of his press office or his press aide or one of his spokesmen. So when Fry was in Berlin in 1935, he went to see Putzi, and Putzi actually told him that the Germans had a plan for what they called the Jewish problem, and that the moderates were voting for emigration, but the extremists, led by Hitler and Dr. Goebbels, were talking about annihilation. And Fry wrote about this, again, for an article that was published in the New York Times in 1935. And he used the word annihilation 30 years later in a letter about the experience, and he wrote, "Annihilation is the word we used because we both spoke English, having both gone to Harvard." So, again, he was shocked by what he heard from this man, Putzi, and this strengthened his anti-fascist conviction enormously. So I would say that these two, you know, the compassion and the conviction were the two sort of twin motivators that led him to volunteer himself in the summer of 1940.
Yeah. He very definitely had some idea then of the dangerous aspects of such a mission.
He did, but, you know, it's interesting. He knew how dangerous it was, and yet he was a very multifaceted and complex man, so I think there was a side of him that was sort of cavalier about it. For example, when he left for France in 1940, he had a round-trip ticket with a four-week return date. He thought he could do the job of helping the refugees in 4 weeks, and he also talked about riding a bicycle through the south of France to help people. So that was his sort of unrealistic, you know, innocent side, I guess. But the other side of him was well aware of what was happening, because you can read that in the letters he wrote to his wife as he was, you know, flying over there. And when he got there, first stop was Lisbon before he went to France. And he talked about what he saw, and he took it seriously. But he always kept that light, sort of laughing at life kind of side to himself also.
I wonder, in order to be a hero, if you have to be a little naive.
Probably, and you probably also have to be a little crazy, I guess, to constantly risk your life. I mean, when he was actually in Marseille, in the throes of his operation, he was risking his life on a daily basis, and his enemies were not just the Gestapo, which were, even though they were not supposed to be in the south of France, they were definitely there. You know, they were obviously there. But the Vichy government, and also his own government, which didn't want any part of him and tried to stop him at every turn.
Yeah. That is such a sad part of this story, the challenges he faced when dealing with his own government. Talk with us about that.
Well, the tenor of the times in the United States in 1940, 1939, as I'm sure you know, is that people really didn't want anything to do with the war that was going on in Europe, or that was about to start in Europe, and after it started in September 1939, we were isolationist, we were nativistic, there was a strong America for Americans movement, and the general public, as shown in many surveys that were done then, really said, let's just keep it over there, it's not our problem, we're not getting involved. And that was one problem that Frye had to deal with, was that general public interest was not really, except for the small group of concerned people in different areas of the country, obviously, they just didn't care, pretty much. And the second problem was our immigration policy was, it was antiquated, and it was based on, well, this is hard to believe, but it was based on census and immigration policy from the 1890s. I mean, it's really incredible. But the numbers, you know, the quota numbers that they set, how many people of each nationality from each country would be allowed in, was based on numbers going back to the 1890s. And they were upgraded and changed and altered with each different census and different immigration laws that were passed in the 20s and 30s. But they were never brought up to date. In other words, there was no rational reason for, say, the government, the United States government, saying, "Well, okay, we'll accept 7,000 Austrians or 12,000 Polish people." And the numbers that we set as the numbers we would take in were completely out of line with what we needed to take in. We needed to take in, you know, tenfold that number. And then the other problem was we didn't even fill our quotas. You know, if you read books like David Wyman's Paper Walls or The Abandonment of the Jews, you find out that during World War II, we didn't even fill our quotas. So say if a quota said, you know, 9,000 Germans could be taken in, we took in maybe 4,000. Mm. So there was enormous obstructionism from the United States State Department and the Visa Division of the State Department, which it is my unfortunate job to have to say was basically anti-Semitic. Breckinridge Long, who ran the Visa Division, was an anti-Semite, and his beliefs filtered down through the whole department. And anti-Semitism was not only rampant in the State Department, but all the foreign offices in different parts of the world, like the consulate, the United States consulate in Marseille. You know, they got their policies from the State Department, and they were anti-Semitic, and most of the refugees were Jewish. So, you know, they really didn't care. They didn't want to help them, and that was the way it was. And Secretary of State Warren Christopher apologized for the State Department's sort of ignoring of Frye or treatment of Frye in during the 90s when Frye was honored at Yad Vashem. But, you know, it wasn't just Frye who was ignored and mistreated, basically.
Yeah. This caused Frye some disappointment, some pain, that his work was ignored, that this part of our history had been ignored, that he was unknown.
Well, I don't think after the war it necessarily caused him any pain. He was actually, when he came home in 1941, he was busy with refugee work from New York on his own for a couple of years, and then in 1945 he published his book Surrender on Demand, telling the whole story. And I think he was sort of okay with the fact that he was not personally recognized, but he was never okay with the State Department, and he was a very strong critic of the State Department for many, many years. And I think it's sad, and it's sort of it was very frustrating for him because he never really got anywhere. And it's kind of, you know, in the book I talk about many different ways that he tried to influence foreign policy, and he never succeeded. You know, he came up with all kinds of different plans for sending food to people in refugee camps in France and things like that, and he never succeeded. So he had a very high degree of frustration with his inability to affect change. And, you know, I think part of it is because while he ran the rescue mission in France for that 13 months, he was in charge, and he ran a wonderful mission. He was very successful. He was very effective at smuggling out refugees, you know, people like Marc Chagall and Jacques Lipschitz and Max Ernst. He smuggled these people out. He did a great job. He was a great leader for that mission. So I guess that afterward he was quite frustrated that he didn't have that kind of effect and he didn't have that kind of meaningful work.
How did the mission work?
Well, when he first arrived in France, thinking, you know, as I said earlier, he could just sort of ride around on a bike and help people, he discovered very quickly that he had a bigger problem on his hands than he had imagined. He found out that the French government was not issuing exit visas, and that meant then that every single person who got out of France had to go out illegally. So he had to sort of change his thinking. He was a journalist, as I said, a writer, an editor. He had not done anything illegal in his life. Suddenly he had to network with the Marseille underworld and find out how the black market worked and develop routes across the Pyrenees over which he could smuggle people out. So that was a huge, enormous sort of challenge for him, and he was very fortunate. He met a young German refugee named Albert Hirschman, who had kept himself alive, running from country to country, using false identities for several years. So Hirschman became Fry's second-in-command. And Hirschman was the sort of street man. He did all the liaisons with the underground and the black market and that kind of thing. He found out how to get false papers. Fry hired a forger named Bill Spira, who he forged all Fry's papers for him for a while until he got arrested. You know, they had to forge papers or falsify papers or use papers of dead people or change photographs. You know, the whole basic Casablanca story, that whole underworld smuggling people out kind of thing. And, you know, there were lots of practical problems. How do you get people to walk across the Pyrenees when they're 70 years old and overweight, that kind of thing? Or when someone has a bad leg and uses crutches. And it was just endless problems. And each individual refugee had a whole litany of problems, and from the paperwork to the physical aspects to the psychological aspects, the uprooting from their homes. It was an enormous, enormous challenge. And the fact that Fry got as many people out as he did is a great testament to his intelligence and his dedication to his work.
Yeah. He was a bright man. He was a journalist. He had a great love for his fellow man. Were there other talents, were there other abilities that he possessed that really helped him in this work?
Well, I think he had an ability to be sort of chameleon-like, so that even though when he went there he was a relatively straightforward young journalist, he quickly learned how to lie and do subterfuge and, you know, pretend one thing to the police and do something else. So he was able to adapt himself to the demands of the job very quickly and very well. He also, as I said earlier, he had kind of a bright, not bright, but maybe a kind of a happy, naive side to him.
Mm-hmm.
A youthful kind of innocence, the, you know, the college boy kind of thing that he always kept with him. And that sort of was a good thing for the refugees. It encouraged them. You know, he always looked on the bright side of things. He never showed them the desperate feelings that he had inside about their situation. He also, when he saw them, he would always maintain a kind of a matter-of-fact attitude in his dealings with them. That's what I've been told by the people I interviewed, so that they would calm down, because most of them were quite, you know, nervous, tense, hysterical, terrified. Many of them were suicidal and did commit suicide. But he always maintained this very matter-of-fact attitude with them, which helped. And he was very factual. He always wanted, you know, they talked about what motivated him, and one of the things that confused them, this is his staff, was his insistence on facts. Everything had to be exactly right. They had to get all the facts when they interviewed a refugee and get them down correctly, and they couldn't understand why this was. So some of them thought it was because he had a journalistic background.
Mm-hmm.
And others of them thought that it was because he thought it would be safer that way if he had all the factual information. But, you know, some people I spoke to said it was just the way he was. You know, very matter-of-fact, factual, down-to-earth, straightforward, and sort of handled it like it was a business kind of thing.
Yeah.
Not life and death, as it was.
Yeah.
Which calmed the refugees considerably. Uh-huh. They found him extremely reassuring.
Well, when you're up against it, having the facts is really important because then it gives you a foundation for what you're going to do.
Right.
And that way you can hopefully conquer that horrible thing called fear.
Yes. And he really was good at that with them.
Yeah. He did have his doubts, though, about what he could accomplish, and he did mm-hmm. have his fears.
Yeah, I mean, in his letters to his wife, Eileen, he talked often about his fears and his doubts. And actually, he also doubted his own courage, as he wrote to his mother in a letter. He wrote something like, courage is not a quality that I thought I possessed. You know, he never thought he was a brave man before this. And I don't even know if he thought he was a brave man after this. I think he just acted. He was such a bright man. He, as I said, he went to Harvard. He was a writer, a journalist, an editor. But I think for this one period of 13 months, he sort of stepped outside himself and became a man of action and didn't really reflect every day on, oh, what am I going to do today? Because I think if you stop to reflect when you're doing something so dangerous as this, then you might not do it yourself. So I think he just got up every morning and said, okay, how many refugees are lined up waiting to see us, and how can we help them, and who can we help, whose life can we save today?
Sheila Eisenberg is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of A Hero of Our Own, The Story of Varian Fry, How One American in Marseille Saved Marc Chagall, Max Ernst, André Breton, Hannah Arendt, and more than 1,000 others from the Nazis. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments. The telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. It had to be very difficult to keep this operation secret, and there were so many people coming to Fry and his people.
Well, you know, he had, I don't know if I've mentioned this, but he had two operations going on at the same time. He had the secret operation, which was his main, you know, what he was actually doing, smuggling the refugees out. But then he had a cover operation, mm-hmm. which was called the American Refuge Center. And he had a whole staff of people working there, interviewing refugees all day, every day. They would determine who needed what, and they would give them money for food, clothing. They would find shelter for them. So they actually did give refugee aid. That was the cover operation, and that was the operation that Fry pretended to the Vichy government that was his, you know, only, that was the only thing he was doing. And then at the end of the day, at 5 o'clock, when everyone, the office would close up, then Fry, they would all go out to dinner, and they would have lengthy dinners with many bottles of wine. And then after that, late at night, they would go back to the office, and they would meet. They would run the water in the bathrooms so that if the phones were tapped or if the office was tapped, no one would hear anything. And they would sit around a long table, Fry and his inner circle, about a half a dozen men, and they would decide, okay, well, we met so-and-so today, and he must be smuggled out because he's one of the most wanted refugees. He's on the Nazis' most wanted list, so how can we get him out? And then they would talk about another man and his wife who had no passports because they were stateless people. They had been, you know, they had run from Germany, and they had no passports. How can we get them passports? That was the kind of stuff they did at night. But during the day, the refugee aid operation was sort of what they did, you know, their cover.
Yeah. That was what was supposed to be legitimate.
Yeah, and it was legitimate. He actually had to get permission from the police to open this office, and they gave him permission.
But even the work, you know, that he was purporting to do through that organization, I wonder, you know, well, how did the Vichy government view it, really?
Well, they viewed him as a big pain in the neck and a big annoyance because he was constantly in their face, constantly asking for things and constantly getting, you know, making requests and like that. I don't know. I don't think that they particularly cared one way or the other about the refugee aid organization, but I think they had some idea what he was up to. And that was what gave them a lot of trouble because, you know, the whole thing started. I mean, the whole motivation back in the beginning, the thing that sparked his trip to France was not only the group getting together in New York and saying we have to help these refugees, but it was the fact that when France fell to Germany, one of the parts of the surrender signed by France was called Article 19, and Article 19 said that any individual wanted by the Germans would have to be surrendered to them on demand. In other words, if Germany said to France, okay, we want Rudolf Breitscheid because he was a high official in the German government before Hitler took over, and he's an anti-Nazi and an anti-fascist, and we want him, so you have to turn him over to us, the French government, the Vichy government would be, you know, they would be forced to turn him over. So that was the whole motivation for, you know, one of the big motivations for the whole operation.
Mm-hmm. Was anyone ever turned away?
In terms of Fry's operation?
Yeah. How did they make the decision, you know?
Yeah, that was very tough. As I said, he went over with 200 names, and obviously once he was there, he realized that 200 names were a drop in the bucket,
right,
and he had to save many more people. I think he made decisions on a daily basis about who to save, and I think that was probably his most difficult task, besides the actual saving and rescuing and smuggling. He had to decide who was most at risk by the Nazis, and he did not pick people because they were Jewish. He picked people because he felt the Nazis would be after them, because they had, during the 1930s, somehow opposed the Nazis. There were many, many labor leaders and political activists whose lives he saved. You know, they make up the bulk of that 1,500 people that he saved. You know, the artists and the writers and the famous names that we know were just, you know, a small percentage. Although, you know, I think it's fair to say that he saved the cream of the crop of, you know, European intellectuals.
Yeah, I mean,
but he also saved, you know, he saved people who ran newspapers, who wrote for newspapers, who had publishing companies, who had organized anti-Hitler resistance in the 30s. You know, he saved all those people. So he really had to choose the people he thought were most in danger. And that's what he tried to do. So I think it was a big responsibility. But, you know, he also, one of the things I haven't mentioned is he had this huge organization that he formed that started forming around him from the day he arrived in Marseille. There were Americans who were expatriates living there. There were some German refugees, French refugees, all different people from all different countries that just sort of coalesced around him and began working for him. A wonderful group of people, some of whom I was fortunate enough to interview in the last few years.
And they remained his friends?
They all remained friends
for life.
Yes, they did. And I will say, of all the refugees that he saved, Jacques Lifschitz and he remained extremely close.
Yeah. Thinking back to that portion of the book where Lifschitz talked about how he didn't want to go to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his wife had, they were ready to commit suicide.
Yes. Yes. He had pills that he had sort of tricked a friend of his into giving him, a doctor. And he carried them around with him. And there was a point during the time he was driving from Paris down to the south of France when he said to his wife, should we take the pills now? And she said, no, let's wait. And they waited, and that was good.
Yeah. And so he, Fry wrote Lipschitz a letter, and then others that Lipschitz knew kind of pushed this couple literally out of their living quarters.
Yes. They, you know, he said that Fry wrote me a severe letter. In other words, a letter that said, this is really serious and you must go now. And the friends came and said, you've got to get out now. And he got out just in time.
Yeah. And he didn't want to go to New York. He was afraid of New York. And then he was sick all the way over.
And yes. And, you know, Chagall was afraid of New York, too. Chagall said, too, he asked Fry if there were cows in the United States. You know, they both, you know, many people had this image of the United States as all buildings and skyscrapers and factories and no countryside. And, you know, when we have to think about what it was like for these people. Their whole heritage, their whole lives were in Europe. And there's one very poignant thing that I read that I think I've quoted in the book by a writer named Zuckerman, who talks about one of the hardest things that they had to leave were all the graves of all the people that they loved and their families that they had to leave behind in Europe when they came here.
The people rescued as a result of Fry's efforts, did they all know him?
What do you mean?
Did they all realize that he was responsible, he and his people were responsible for their lives?
Sure, yeah, definitely. Yeah. They had dealings with Fry and his group on a daily basis. They knew him very well, and many of them were very grateful and corresponded with him afterward. But as I said, Lipschitz and he were, I think of all of them, remained the closest.
Yeah. What do you hope readers will take away from this story?
Well, first of all, of course, I would like recognition for Varian Fry, so that instead of people calling him America's Schindler, they'll start calling Schindler Germany's Fry. You know, I mean, they say, oh, yes, the artist Schindler or the American Schindler, and everyone knows Schindler, but it's my hope that everyone will begin to know Fry and know that this man gave so much and saved so many people and such an amazing group of people. I also hope that, you know, he can be seen as a role model for doing good for other people, for putting yourself second and putting everyone else first.
Mm. Well, it's quite a story.
Thank you. It is.
Growing up, did you have people that you read about that you came to admire as a result of reading books? I'm curious about that.
That's a funny question, you know, because just when you asked me that question, this amazing thing popped into my head that I had completely forgotten about. When I was a kid growing up, I belonged to some kind of a book club, and I cannot remember the name of it, but I remember that every month I got a book in the mail about a different hero. And until you asked me that question, I had completely forgotten about it. And I remember reading 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, about General Doolittle, and different heroes, Helen Keller. Yeah. So I did read books about people who had done great things, and I think it did influence me, obviously, but until you asked me the question, I had definitely forgotten about that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's something that today would be worth reflecting on, is who are our heroes and why? And, you know, if you're a person who believes in prayer, maybe saying a little prayer that if you ever called to that,
that you could rise
sacrifice,
to the occasion.
Yeah. Sheila, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you, Celeste, for having me.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Sheila Eisenberg has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. If you're interested in learning more about Varian Fry, look for Sheila's book, A Hero of Our Own, The Story of Varian Fry, How One American in Marseille Saved Marc Chagall, Max Ernst, André Breton, Hannah Arendt, and more than 1,000 others from the Nazis. The book is published by Random House.